The History of Horror Uncut is a Shudder original podcast. Download the Shudder app or visit Shudder.com and enter the code SHUDDERPOD to start your free 2-week trial. That's promo code SHUDDERPOD. I'm Shudder curator Sam Zimmerman. This is the History of Horror Uncut, an essential audio companion to Eli Roth's History of Horror. Eli Roth's History of Horror is a 7-episode docuseries threading the evolution and immortality of the genre and all its terrors within. These are the full, candid interviews, most of which can only be found and heard right here in this podcast. You'll hear how the genre shaped these filmmakers, authors, makeup maestros. You'll hear the personal, unbridled appreciation that only comes from those who know how special horror can be. Welcome to a more intimate history of horror. The History of Horror Uncut is built with the full raw interviews conducted in production for Eli Roth's History of Horror. In some cases, Eli leads the talk itself, and in others, deeply knowledgeable producer Kurt Sienga stepped in. Today is one of Eli's most exciting, if really only to hear his own spilling thrill to sit down with the world's horror dad and idol to all of us, Stephen King. Stephen King's legacy is unparalleled. The author of Carrie and Salem's Lot, The Stand, The Shining, Pet Sematary, The Dark Tower, It. For so many, Stephen King is not only the gateway, but the guide, a storyteller, a professor, a family member. His constant outpouring has kept us company throughout our whole horror-loving lives. He has been extraordinary in his ability to be expressly mainstream and yet so true to his visions, themes, and the genre, most recently embodied in the stunning 2018 horror novel, The Outsider. Though outspoken on social media and prolific in writing, it still really feels like we don't actually hear from King all that much. So it's a treat to present a lengthy, candid talk with this master of the macabre, one that touches on the genre, his own fandom and insights, and of course the many avenues of his work, including process and film adaptations. Here now is Eli Roth and Stephen King. Listen up, ghouls.
First, we're both huge horror fans. Obviously, my gateway drug into reading was your books. I mean, there was an anthology with Children of the Corn and right. Skeleton Crew. And I remember being, and I went to summer camp in Maine, in Casco, Maine, sitting there like with a flashlight, going to bed.
That's right next door to where I live, man.
I loved it. Do you think there's something about growing up on the East Coast and the woods at night that just gives you an appreciation, a flavor for horror? And, or is it the torture of being a Red Sox fan?
It's neither one of those things. It's just something that you grow up with, and every kid, you know, wants to take a chance and see how much they can take.
Yeah. I remember sitting, probably my first experience is sitting, like when you have a sleepover with friends, is telling scary stories or a ghost story or urban legend. What was your, do you remember, like, was there a gateway drug, like one experience you had with scare that you got addicted to the feeling?
Boy, I can remember watching a lot of movies on WPIX when I was a little kid, you know, and they showed the same thing over and over again. And for me, although it's hilarious now, at 4 years old, it was scary. There was a picture called Robot Monster, and it was basically it was a guy from space with a diving helmet on, you know, and it's ridiculous now. And then there was The Creature from the Black Lagoon. And what I remember, maybe 5 or 6 years old, and watching that thing on TV, it was the girl in the white bathing suit, and the creature is right below her and reaching up and not quite touching her foot, and I'm going like, you know, and I'm thinking at that point, that's scary as hell, and I would like to do that. But the other thing was the Tales from the Crypt comic books.
And, the EC comics, I love those. Yeah.
Because really, what is a comic book? It's a storyboard for a movie. Right, so we went ahead and George and I, you know,
Creepshow is one of my all-time favorite movies.
We wanted to do that, and you know, my first thing with George was he said we ought to work together and do something. I'm like, I'm down with that, and I thought about it a little bit, and I said, why don't we just do a movie that's all like, you know how comedy skits have blackouts?
Yeah.
And I was thinking to myself, let's do a number of horror blackouts. You know, just show a guy, you know, who's doing the garbage disposal and pushing stuff in there, and all at once it starts up and the blood goes everywhere. And George thought, well, yeah, but why don't we do a number of stories like Tales from the Crypt? And I went, yeah, let's do that.
I remember seeing Creepshow There are so many things I love about that movie. And you look back now, it's Ed Harris with hair. Other things.
Yeah, right.
But the cockroaches was the thing at school.
Yeah.
That was like the thing that was like everyone was talking about. Yeah. The image of E.C. Marshall. I find with horror, the first time you watch it, there's that shocking image. I always say blood stains your eyes. But then the second time you watch it, it's not as scary, but you notice other things. And then there's some random line like,
"Well, you're a director,
Mr.
And you,
Pratt,
you do that." But see, the thing was, Savini was the guy who did the effects on that movie.
Genius.
And he did, I did Jordy Verrill, so he did a cast of me. And it was a little bit freaky because it was so claustrophobic, you know, to have that stuff all over your face and they put a thing in your mouth,
yeah,
you know, that you can breathe through. So E.G. came in because it was going to be a thing at the end where the bugs were just going to sort of explode out of him. And they wanted to do a full face cast of him and have the bugs explode out of his body. The guy says to him, you know, Tom says, you know, we're going to cover you. Are you claustrophobic? Because this stuff is going to be all over your face. And E.G. is just as flat as could possibly be. No, but can I have some bourbon tipped into the straw every now and then? So they have him covered with this stuff.
And they have like an eyedropper?
A little tiny bit of bourbon in all the time, and he did it. And when we did the final scene, he just sort of explodes with bugs all inside him. Everybody was like nervous, scared to death. It could be one take.
Yeah.
That's the only thing you could do. There were like 5,000 cockroaches, and they were going to blow them through this tube, you know, pneumatically.
I know. Now you'd have a digital cockroach.
You had the cockroaches. They were everywhere, Eli.
Yeah.
Those cockroaches were everywhere. And the people started to just freak out of him. And George would see these cockroaches climbing over him, and he would just brush them off. There was nothing to it. So there was this quiet on the set. Okay, set, get the cockroaches ready, cue the cockroaches kind of thing. And it's a white room, and they did it, and it was perfect, and everybody in the place just exploded into applause.
It's one of the great, great moments in movies. I often hear this criticism of horror, that people will watch a movie, it terrifies them, and then go back years later and go, it doesn't hold up.
Yeah.
And I think that that's kind of a bullshit criticism, because it's almost like cologne or perfume that wears off. I mean, you will never be as scared of the haunted house the second time. It just drives me crazy when people go, oh, Evil Dead's the scariest movie. And they go, I remember it being much scarier. The great thing about horror is it'll never get you as much as it did the first time. And you're always like chasing that dragon to get that thrill again.
Well, you see the art the second time. You see the art the third time. I can remember just sort of wandering into a screening of Night of the Living Dead. It was in the afternoon, and it was like a Saturday or something. The place was full of kids. There were no rating system per se then. The whole place was full of kids. It was like a Saturday matinee. And they're all, you know, yelling and grab-assing around and throwing their popcorn boxes. And that thing got going, and they just fell entirely silent. And they're just all eyes. And I'm thinking to myself, and I was scared too. The first time that you see something like that, you're not prepared for what you're looking at. I mean, there were things that were so transgressive in that movie. The little girl stabs
little
her mother.
The
to
little
death.
Kid killing her mom? No one had ever seen anything like that.
Eli, the first time you see it, you're just horrified. You can't believe what you're seeing. The second time you see it, you see the art. I mean, this was a movie that was made on the quick. It was independent. There wasn't any money behind it to speak of. You see the shadows on the wall, the blood splattering there that's black and white, and it's very, the contrast. He goes back and forth between that and the light bulb that's going back and forth.
Yeah.
And you see the shadows. You see him going across
his
faces.
You made that brilliant connection between the shadows in Night of the Living Dead and the birds, where, you know, see Tippi Hedren waving the light.
Well, I'm sure that's...
George got it from.
You know, so you see the art. I mean, the first time that you watch the birds, you just freak, and you say to yourself, I'm totally involved in the story. You're totally lost in it. That's why, you know, they kind of pull you in there, and then all at once, you're terrified because you can't get out. The second time, you see some of the stuff that he's doing, like with the aerial shot, with the bird in the foreground, and he looks down, and you see the fire coming up on the town from where the guy crashed the car. So.
And when they look at the camera and they're like, you brought us here, you're the reason. Addressing the audience
But let me tell you something, too. The people who make these movies, don't understand. You don't understand when you make something, whether it's going to work or not. It's like comedy in a way. It's very, like, who would have thought the Blair Witch Project would work the way that it was? The first time I saw that movie, I was in the hospital and I was doped up. My son brought a VHS tape of it and he said, you got to watch this. Halfway through it, I said, turn it off, it's too freaky, I can't.
I had the same experience. A friend of mine said, hey, I made this movie, it just got into Sundance, and he gave me a tape of it, and I watched it, and it was, and I was like, I have to turn the lights on. I was so disturbed by the end of the movie.
It's disturbing.
I was like, I get chills thinking about how scared I was. The memory of how scared I was when I watched The Blair Witch Project, I'd never seen, and the fact that the ending, they drop the camera, the guy's on the wall, and it's over. Yeah. And then they started the campaign of, like, is it real, is it fake, and then it caught on. The same, and again, Paranormal Activity scared me same way.
That's a different thing. The advertising campaign for that movie, it was fucking brilliant.
The first time a website was used in the making, in the marketing of a movie. Yeah.
But the thing is, it wouldn't have worked if the movie didn't work. But the movie really disturbed people.
It was so scary. I mean, I try to think of those seminal experiences where, you know, I have, like, markers in my brain. But you had the experience with Bambi, as, like, almost your first horror. My first horror movie was Pinocchio. And I don't even remember. My parents reminded me I was completely obsessed with Pinocchio. And I was terrified of the whale. Yeah. That scared me so much. And then it was a reviewer that years later pointed out the similarities between Hostel and Pinocchio. Of the three boys going to Amsterdam looking for sex is like Pinocchio going to Pleasure Island and being turned into the jackass by Stromboli. It's weird. We can't escape our obsessions from childhood.
That was the thing about Pinocchio that scared me, was they were growing ears. You could tell that whatever they were doing,
scary.
They didn't understand what was happening to them. The first movie that terrified me to the point where I could barely look at it was The Haunting of Hill House.
The Haunting was so scary.
Probably 11 years old, and you never really see anything until that woman
that
comes.
That door's pounding is like the scariest sound. I remember
and
that.
And the door kind of bulges.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it builds up and it builds up, and finally she's going up these stairs, this ratty, you know, rattly, unsteady spiral staircase. And the trap door opens, and it's the professor's wife, and she goes, ah!
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I'm dead. I had a heart attack. I'm never going to grow up.
Well, it's also a feeling of no one will ever do anything as scary as this again. You're like, the scariest haunt, and then Paranormal Activity comes out, and then The Conjuring comes out, and you're just thinking, okay, James makes scary moves, and it's freaking as soon as she goes, let's play the game, clap, clap. But we've talked about, I mean, I know I've read a lot about The Changeling. I love The Changeling and the image
of the ball.
Of the ball, the bouncing ball. Have you seen Fellini's Toby Dammit?
Nope.
You've got to see Toby Dammit. Spirits, it was part of an anthology called Spirits of the Dead, where Roger Vadim, Louis Malle, and Fellini each adapted a Poe short story.
Oh, cool.
And Poe adapted one called Never Bet the Devil Your Head. And they released it as a 40-minute standalone feature, as Terrence Stamp is this crazy drunk, like, drug addict actor from England who goes to Italy to make a spaghetti western, but he's haunted by the image of a little girl that is a white girl with a bouncing ball that she wants to play with him.
And Spirits he knows of the Dead?
It's called Spirits of the Dead. I'm going to find it. On the Criterion released one that's in French. I have the English and Italian. It's hard to find. But it's like, it's got the image of the little girl and the white bouncing ball. And the music is very similar. Nino Rota's music is very similar to Halloween. Nothing to do with the show.
There was a trilogy, one of the American International Pictures back in the day. You're too young to remember, but I saw them all theater.
I remember Nosferatu.
This goes earlier than that. But there was one of those guys who adapted Nikolai Gogol's story, The Ring. And it's a very, very simple story. The best ones always are. And basically, this woman is buried with this expensive ring on her hand. She's in a crypt. And he goes in, and she started to decay a little bit. And he steals the ring, and she comes out of the grave to get it. Simple, but scary.
Sometimes when I'm starting a movie, I'll think of a kill. Like in Cabin Fever, I was like, oh, she shaves her legs off. Mm-hmm. And you write the movie basically as an excuse to do the scene.
To do the scene.
My wife
saying lobster is basically an excuse to eat butter.
It's so true. Yes.
Yeah, it's the same.
Do you start
thing.
With the lobster or the butter, or does it just depend story to story?
Okay, a lot of times with shorter fiction, I start with something that I really want to do to creep the reader out or to scare the hell out of him. I've got a story now that I want to write, but I can't tell you. I mean, it has to do with a guy who gets buried with a cell phone in his pocket.
Okay.
I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you all.
Right, no, don't tell us. But I'm just. Yeah. But it starts with that seed of that, oh, I want to see someone. What would you do in this?
And, you know, and I'm walking on our road here, and somebody was building something, and there was one of those porta-potties out there. And I thought to myself, you know what? What would happen if somebody got locked in one of those? You know, how would he get out? And I'm thinking, well, he'd have to go through the hole and crawl through all that stuff down there and somehow find a way out. So I called somebody that I knew in construction and I said, how hard would it be to get into a porta potty and escape through the bottom? And he goes like, yuck!
Yeah.
And I thought, I got something here.
That's it.
I got something.
Sometimes I'll tell someone an idea and they go, oh, that's too crazy, you can't do
but
that.
But there are moments.
And that's what I know.
There are moments that I remember. There's a Fulci film, Luigi Fulci.
There's
Lucia a zombie or somebody.
Zombie 2. Grabs the splinter.
Right.
Splinter
and it
through
goes
the
into
eye.
The eye.
Zombie 2.
Yeah.
That's one of the best kills ever in movies.
Yeah.
I thought Lucio Fulci, for me, is probably the most underrated director. Mm-hmm. I've seen his early comedies, his giallo films, Don't Torture a Duckling, Seven Doors of Death, The Beyond, I love. Zombie 2 is one of the best things because it's a ripoff of Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
They needed a sequel, so in Italy, Dawn of the Dead was released as zombies.
Don't forget the zombie that has the fight with the shark.
That's the greatest thing ever in a movie. It's Zombie 2.
It's totally, it's totally over the top.
Lucio Fulci, actually, and I'm friends with his daughter, Antonella, because I wanted to know how did a guy fight a zombie. He put a stuntman who had trained a shark in zombie makeup in the ground. And he had a shark that, I mean, they think they drugged the hell out of the shark. The guy puts his arm in the shark. This guy knew the shark well enough to put his arm in the shark. It's actually, they shot the whole movie for $200,000. It's a guy holding his breath in zombie makeup, you know, putting his arm in a shark. The shark bites the zombie bites the shark, and the shark swims away. It has absolutely nothing to do with the movie, but it's probably one of the greatest scenes ever in horror films.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to have a lot to do with the movie a lot of times because these things are like dreams.
I've always felt that. I always felt that movies were the conscious, were the closest representation to what it is when you have a dream. And our memory of movies and our memory of dreams become very similar. If I think about a dream I had and I think about a movie I saw years ago, they have the similar type of feeling. And I've always felt that horror films are the closest representation to our dreams. There's almost no logic. You can kind of go anywhere. What is it? I mean, I've thought about this and talked about this over and over. Being scared is not an emotion we want to feel in real life. We do everything to avoid being afraid. But what is it about reading scary books, telling scary stories, novels that we just love? It's just some incredible, incredible endorphin release.
It's safe. It's a safe thing. It's a safe place to go. There are two different sides to this. One is there are movies, Death Wish is one. Okay, mm-hmm. Your picture, Death Wish, the original, the Michael Winner, I think mm-hmm. it was.
Yes, yeah, Michael Winner.
There are a number of pictures like the Friday the 13th movies, the Freddy movies, where you're able to actually take your deepest, most antisocial impulses for a walk. Mm-hmm. And it's safe. Nobody gets hurt. We understand on one level that it's not happening, but on another level, it's as real as any of our fantasies. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is, what you just said is true. We don't really like to be scared in real life, but in a movie, we have a chance to be afraid and to almost externalize the fears that we have. There are things in some movies that are like classic moments. The girl who is alone in a parking garage, mm-hmm. and you hear the click clack. I can't see any movie where some character is in a parking garage where I don't say to myself, something awful is going to happen to this person.
It's just bad news.
And then there's the hospital, okay? The mm-hmm. person who's in the hospital and
the nurse
helpless.
Goes, I'll be right back.
That's
and you're
right.
in the bed. I'm
That's
just
right.
down the hall if you need me. Just ring that buzzer.
Just
and you're going, their hand's not going to reach it.
Yeah.
I've heard from soldiers on military bases who tell me, they're like, I can't watch your movies. Well, they'll show Hostel or something on a military base and people are screaming and covering their eyes, but they have to go out mm-hmm. and, you know, face real death every
day. Because they do, you know, it's a different thing. But for most of us, we have that experience. There's another side of it too. There's the imagination mm-hmm. side of it. What would I do in this situation? Are these characters behaving in a way that I would behave? for me, man, if I was in a cabin somewhere and I whipped out my iPhone and I say, I got no signal, I'd get the hell out of there right away because, you know, that's, I know that situation. I, you know that someone's going to come out of the woods at that point.
When I was a kid, I used to plan escape routes. My parents would be like, good night. And before I went to bed, have to map out about 15. I'd be like, if I go out the window and I can jump on that branch and I can use this weapon and I can grab this pocket knife, I just think it's something we naturally do.
So one thing is we're getting a chance to exercise our most antisocial emotions. Mm-hmm. You know, that mob impulse. It's like, kill them all and let God sort them out. The other thing is we get to experience fear, that roller coaster thing. We're scared to death, but at the same time, we know we're safe. So it's a chance to explore emotions in safety that we don't get a chance to. And the other thing is just pure imagination. You have a chance to see things that you wouldn't ordinarily see in a movie, and it's, you know, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, well, it's also slowing down and watching the car accident, knowing
someone's really not dying.
But I also think, you know, as kids, I'm just going more philosophical than I talk specifically about movies. As kids, we all tell each other, don't be afraid. Go do it. Don't be scared. When your older brother's daring you to do something, it's like, come on, jump off. You know, jump off that woodshed. Don't be afraid. Climb that tree higher. Don't be scared. Don't be scared. And as you get older, we're not allowed to be scared. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone can freak out about the political climate. We can freak out about war. We can freak out. But you're not supposed to. You have to bury it down. But it's in there, and it's brewing. And I feel like the stuff you've written, I know for me, it's like, oh, this is a way for me to be afraid without being seen as a coward by society.
Exactly.
I've had the pleasure of watching your movies as a kid before I read the book, and in some cases I read the book first and then watched it. Do you enjoy watching adaptations, or has it
sure.
evolved?
I like to watch adaptations, and I'm always interested to see what people do with the stuff. I have a program that I call Dollar Babies, and people who are aspiring filmmakers,
yes.
if it's something that isn't under contract, I'll say, sure, go ahead. You have to sign a contract, you have to pay me a buck, and you have to say, I won't show this for profit unless I say you can't. Frank Darabont did one, The Woman in the Room. That's mm-hmm. that's where he got his start. But man, I just love it because there was some guy who did a version of a story I wrote called The Sundog with Gumbies.
Okay.
You know, and it was really interesting. It was also fucking hilarious. So you see people who do funny stuff, you see stuff, people who just, and you say, well, this doesn't work. But then other things you say, there's real talent here. One of the things that I've always liked about horror movies, and this goes right back to Roger Corman, who gave so many people
a
start.
The greatest.
You know? One of the movies that scared the hell out of me was Dementia 13.
I know, Coppola. I was shooting it on a weekend while they're shooting another movie in 2 days in a castle in Ireland.
But you see the talent there. You see the ability to choose what's going to make people afraid. Jonathan Demme, mm-hmm. some of the early stuff. I like that. So one of the things about horror movies that I like is it's kind of still considered to be a low end. I said to you, this is my favorite time of year to go to the movies because this is where they supposedly dump stuff, but a lot of times it's fabulous.
I will watch anything that's a horror movie. I don't care how bad it is.
You know what?
I love it. I'm like three on a meat hook. I'm like a garbage disposal.
I'm Midnight Meat Train. I got to tell you something. The worst horror movie I ever saw was fucking great.
Yeah,
okay?
It's true.
That's the way that I am because I go in there and I say, what am I going to see? I don't know.
Yeah,
don't
well, know. Then there are
and
movies
the other
that
thing about this is like the ratings system. A movie that's PG-13, that's a horror movie, it's got to be scary in some way that's really artistic. Once you get to R or once you get to unrated, you're saying, I don't know what I'm going to see.
I know.
Like that.
Well, I've always felt that synergy with punk rock. And you've talked about that too, where you're like, it's almost think it's going to upset your parents, it's going to piss people off, you're not supposed to see it. But I remember seeing movies like The Mutilator, where it was like by axe, by pick, by hook, bye-bye. And just the box art alone of the hook. And there's literally nothing clever about this movie. It's just like, he's the mutilator.
Hey.
And they don't even have a mystery of who it is. It's just like, oh, your dad, he just got out of prison. Let's go to the cabin anyways. And then they show him, and he kills everybody. But he's the mutilator. But I love it.
I got one word for you. Maniac.
I got something for you.
Listen, hey, who was that? William Lustig?
That was Bill Lustig with Joe Spinell and Caroline Monroe.
Right.
Maniac is one of my favorite movies, and I had a feeling you'd like it.
Maniac.
Which is why, as a gift for you, I brought you a Maniac action figure.
We did not rehearse this, folks. Look.
A Maniac action figure.
I'm so excited, I almost dropped it. It's a Maniac bloody scalp.
Isn't that sweet? Yeah.
It really is. I mean, I don't know how to thank you for that.
You can enjoy that. That's a little memento of this conversation.
Yeah.
It's a Maniac figure.
Yeah,
I love Maniac because, by the way, I did a ripoff of the poster for Hostel, and Bill Lustig told me that he had the guy with a knife in the head, and he specifically told the artist, the guy has to have an erection. And they put a huge, that was the days in Times Square, they had like a huge giant billboard of it and people were outraged. I was like, we have to rip that, we have to do our own homage for Hostel. And they wound up using it in Europe as like the main poster.
There you go.
I love Maniac, but that had those incredible Savini effects of the scalping and all of them coming to life at the end. But it was also Joe Spinell, who's one of my favorite actors of all time.
How about Herschel Gordon Lewis?
Herschel Gordon Lewis is
Have you ever had a real Italian feast?
Blood Feast is the best. And 2000 Maniacs, Blood Feast, The Wizard of Gore. Herschel Gordon Lewis and David F. Friedman.
All drive-in picks, man. I was there.
$40,000 to $50,000. Blood Feast with, the guts being ripped out. He's the first guy that went to the butcher shop, got the pig entrails, and then just had people ripping them out.
Right.
He was one of the greats, Herschel Gordon Lewis. But that must have been, but you got to see those movies as a kid. I was watching them on VHS after I had already seen Dawn of the Dead, so the effects kind of pale. But you got to,
it's what we were talking about before. You see it done a certain way, and then you go back to the originators, and you say, well, yeah, not that great, but it's part of the
evolution.
It's the evolution, yeah.
Yeah, what was it like seeing, you got to see the boundary pushed going from the 1950s creatures, the man in the rubber suit, to like graphic viscera.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like seeing it pushed farther and farther?
It was transgressive. I keep coming back to that word. You say to yourself, I never saw anything like that in a film. And I do think that after a while, there gets to be a numbing effect. You get sort of numb to some of this stuff. Like when I was a kid and something like Psycho, the first time that I saw Psycho, that audience was in hysterics. And you don't see that much anymore. People are used to these various effects. I mean, the last time I really think that I heard an audience shriek, I take that back a little bit because there were some shrieks in Blair Witch, some people. But I can remember people shrieking at, I can remember so well that I've forgotten, but you have to remember that I'm 70 years old now. I can certainly remember, the reaction in the shower scene in Psycho, and you never see the knife go in, so it's an amazing thing.
But it's also, I remember reading a lot with Wes Craven talking about watching the Vietnam footage on television and then making Last House on the Left as a visceral reaction to that, which is like full entrails being pulled out.
Yeah.
I think that culturally seeing war on television must have done something because you can just see this, almost tectonic shift in the violence that gets into the movies with, obviously the Scorsese films and the Francis Ford Coppola and the film brat films of the 70s, but what horror did in the 70s, Last House on the Left, but then Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's a work of art.
It is. It is a work of art. And that's another movie where you think you see a lot more than you see. And isn't that pretty much the original Spam in a Cabin movie? That's the first one where these kids are out there, they can't get out, and you have, that whole thing about the last girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the final girl starts with Marilyn Burns.
I think that's...
But the meat hook scene is what we remember, where Pam gets hung on the meat hook, and the sound effect is so effective.
I know.
And you just like, and it's also her acting. I always, I remember when I had fights with the ratings board, they were really giving me a difficult time on Hostel 2, and when the girl's hung upside down being bled in a bathtub. And I said, if her acting was bad, would it be as effective? And they were like, well, no. And then I said, well, don't blame the movie because the acting, but that girl, when that thing goes through her chest, and she's like, and she doesn't die right away, but she's gasping for air.
Yeah.
You, whatever it does to your subconscious, you 100% remember you see the meat hook going through.
How about where Leatherface goes back into that thing and slams
the door slam. When he grabs her and pulls her in and slams her, well, the shot under the swing. If there's one movie that's the well I'm always drinking out of to rip things off. I remember with the with James Wan, the director of Saw, we would jokingly just try and one-up each other when it was Hostel and Saw. And then we had to call each other and but eventually just sort of divide up body parts. I was like, well, I'm cutting off a penis in Hostel 2. He's like, well, I'm doing a guy with a bunch of nipple rings. I was like, I was going to do nipple ring. We had to, like, split the body parts.
It's funny, though. I mean, what you were saying before about directors and writers, you know, basically hanging the story because they want to do one thing. Steven Spielberg and I talked a lot about Poltergeist. He wanted me to write it, and we had some kind of a mix-up. I would have written it if it was today, and we could have emailed back and forth, but there was a loss of communications. Mm-hmm. I was on a boat going across the Atlantic Ocean to England, and he didn't get a reply, and he got all... But what he said to me was, I want to do a ghost kiss. And I said, oh, really? I mean, this whole movie about ghosts and the people in the house and the little girls and everything, and you're fixated on that? I mean, I didn't actually say that. It was Steven Spielberg. But, yeah, he's going like, I want to do a ghost kiss, and I know just how I'm going to do it, sort of. I'm going to put a piece of glass down, and the ghost is going to kiss her, and you're going to see her lips move and kind of get a little bit white, and the pressure is going to... So you're going to see the ghost kissing her without the ghost. He said, but... I don't know how to get rid of the smear on the glass. And I said, well, I don't even think it's in the movie, but it was interesting.
It's funny that that was the image that was in his head.
That was the thing. That was the hook he hung the whole thing on. And, man, I've done books where I've said, I want to finish up. I want this particular thing in there. And by the time the story gets there, it's changed completely. And so I think it's like that ghost kiss. I just finished a novel. I was thinking beforehand, way back to childhood, you know, I was thinking, like, wouldn't it be cool? One time I was in school and I said, wouldn't it be cool if this school just started to move and then it picked up speed, and I had an image in my mind of the school running over roads and knocking down trees and putting this path through the woods and crashing through houses and coming into town and running people down and all that other stuff. And I said, I really want to kind of go back to that and do something with that. And there's a scene that's within shouting distance of that in the book, but it never really...
Never quite hit it. Do you get inspired by movies? We ever watch a movie and go, that's so scary, I need to one-up it or do my version of that?
Yeah, or sometimes I'll be watching a movie and I'll be thinking to myself, you know, this is a really interesting situation. I wonder if I could come at this in a different direction and I could do something that has that feel of that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, interesting you brought up Poltergeist, because Poltergeist, for me, the thing I remember the most out of all the effects was the clown.
Sure.
And that clown doll was the scare... That was the first image that terrified me from clowns, and then, of course, it comes along, and here we are years later, and it's the biggest horror film of all time. Tell me about your experience watching it from the book, which I remember the summer the book came out, everyone was reading it. We all had our, like, copies of it this big, no matter where we were. And then watching the television adaptation and Andy Muschietti's film. What was that like, experiencing the new
first
bit?
Of all, the clowns hate me. You know, most clowns are really good people, and they love children, and they go to hospitals, and they make a living and everything. In fact, I have an assistant up in Maine whose husband, part-time, is a clown for something, and he tries to be nice to me because his wife works for me and everything, but you can see...
You can tell he's pissed. Give me this that's like me
but
with tourist
You points. Know, I just tell people, don't hate the messenger for the message. Kids are scared to death of clowns. You know, clowns are a natural disguise for monsters because you never know what's under that makeup.
And John Wayne Gacy did those clown paintings.
John Wayne Gacy did the
clowns. But tell me your experience seeing the new... Are you involved with the movie when you see it? What did you... I mean, that opening sequence with the yellow raincoat was one of the best openings in horror movies in a long time.
I wasn't involved with the miniseries, and I wasn't involved with this. I've talked with Andy since then, and I think the movie was partially a success because a lot of kids saw the miniseries when they were 11 or 12, and it was pretty scary for TV, and it made a mark on them. And when the movie came out, they really wanted to see that. But the thing is, Andy shot the shit out of that movie. He really did. He did a terrific job with the movie, and he stuck to the kids part of the book, which was dynamite, a dynamite
it's
idea.
It's amazing. It had shades of Stand By Me in the movie.
Yeah, it did, but it did from the book, too. I mean, it's still, you know, the sort of from the point of view of looking up, from the kids' point of view. I always think of when I'm working on it or when I was working on Stand By Me, you know how in the Peanuts cartoons, you know, the adults don't really have voices. They just go, wah, 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 wah. And that's what it is for kids, pretty much. So, first of all, I got a jinx thing. If people are in touch with me a lot about something, I always feel like maybe they've lost their way. But the worst jinx of all is never send me swag from a movie before the movie
comes out.
Never send me a
That'll
hat.
That'll put the whammy on it.
It puts the whammy on it completely. So I didn't really have anything to do with that. I knew some of the history when that guy, whose last name I can't pronounce, Cary Fukunaga. You know, when he was involved, I'd seen True Detective, and I thought, well, I wish he was doing it, but I knew Andy's work from
Mama. Yeah, Mama was terrific.
So I said, we got a real chance here. He's got a chance to do something really good because the script was very, very strong. It was very smart. They knew the right things to put in and the right things to leave out. I saw it. They asked me, would I want to see a rough cut down here in Sarasota? And this was probably 8 months before the movie was released. So it was a really early cut, but I looked at it and I said, this thing's gonna be huge. It's perfect. It really works. You just know from the beginning, because when Georgie is running down the gutter after the boat, it looks like a real rainstorm. It doesn't look like a sunny day where people ran a rain machine. It looks like
it was gloomy really and over. Worked. And once they rip it, when they ripped his arm off, you go, oh my God, this is unstable narrator. See, anything can happen. Anyone can go.
It was a mainstream movie that was rated R. This is going to be a big thing for the next few years because you've got people who grew up on PG-13 who are now 18, 19 years old and they're ready for something that's a little bit stronger. And those people responded like crazy to that
movie. Played like a family film. It became the movie you were dared to see.
And there were laughs in it and everything. And kids talked about it that were too young to see it, and I think a lot of them saw it anyway, and that's the way it should work. It should be forbidden. This kind of thing should be forbidden. Hostel is a forbidden movie. You know, you go see it and you say, whoa. When I was a little kid, I can remember clearly being on the bus stop, standing around, you know, where I was maybe a fourth or fifth grade. And this kid comes up to me and says, because this was a time when they had like full page ads for exploitation pictures because they were going to be there for a week and then they were going to be gone. This kid walks up to me and says, Stevie, are you going to go see McBear? And I'm like, what? McBear? He says, yeah, it's going to be really, really scary. There's a kid that gets buried alive. It's called McBear. Well, finally figured out he was talking about Macabre. It was a William Patterson. And I did go to see it, and it did scare me.
McBear.
When they open the coffin, the kid looks black.
Yeah.
You know, from asphyxiation or something.
Let's talk about another adaptation.
So what I'm saying is it was forbidden. You know, that was the kind of thing.
My mom was like, you are not to watch House of Wax. I was like, can I watch Caligula?
Yes.
And they were like,
I got to go see it. I got to go see it.
But it's weird that to my mom, House of Wax was the most forbidden. I could watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Dawn of the Dead, because she'd be like, oh, that's just makeup effects. House of Wax was truly, that was the one. And then I remember seeing it being like, this isn't scary at all. It's like every generation has their House of Wax.
I taught a film class, horror films. I did this book called Dance Macabre.
Yeah, I love Dance Macabre.
Dance McBear.
Dance McBear is one of my favorites. The Dancing Bear.
And it sort of grew out of my notes for this class that I did on films and books. I mean, we read the books, we looked at the films. And one of the films that really worked for me as a kid for a lot of different complex reasons was The Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Don Siegel's great film.
And one of the things was I fell in love with the girl, you know, Becky.
Yeah.
Who turns into a pod at the end of the movie.
I know. The whole time you're like, don't let her fall asleep.
So I remember that, and I remember the pods, and I remember how it gave me goosebumps when it opens and you see the sort of blank faces and all that foam and everything. So I showed it to my college class. They laughed.
They laughed. Well, you should have shown them the remake where Brooke Adams stands up naked and points. That was pretty...
Oh!
That one of the best ending shots ever.
What I remember about that is Donald Sutherland being a health inspector. And
a rat turd.
He says, then the chef says, it's not a rat turd, it's a caper.
It's a caper.
And Donald Sutherland says,
if it's a caper, eat it. Then eat it.
Yeah.
Cut to him shoveling the rice. The Shining. I saw that as a kid. I had no preconceived. It was that for me was the movie you were warned against seeing.
Yep.
And it was a weird. And it was. I was not old enough to read the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could have read it, but I was like 10 years old. It would have been like a bit too much for me. And I watched it, and I remember being completely puzzled, confused, like wanting to watch it again to figure it out, terrified. Your reaction watching it, I mean, you were never a fan. It was so different from the book. Are you able to enjoy the movie at all on any level, or is it just not an interesting movie?
I can enjoy it on the same level that you could enjoy a beautifully restored Cadillac without a motor in it. You know, it's a gorgeous film to look at. Absolutely gorgeous. The soundtrack is gorgeous to look at. You know, I've said this before. My rap about it is there's no character arc in the book. Jack Torrance goes from a nice guy who's trying to get better for his family and for himself. I had an image going into that of a thin piece of metal that you bend back and forth until it snaps. And I felt like Jack Nicholson played Jack Torrance as though he were crazy from the
crazy
jump.
From minute one.
He's talking with Mr. Ullman in the office, and Ullman's saying this and that, and Jack's going, yes, absolutely, Mr. Ullman.
He's nuts from the first minute when they're in the house.
So I felt there wasn't any character arc, but I also thought that Kubrick had taken a pretty strong, scary, suspense, horror novel and turned it into an art film. And I kind of went like, I can remember screening it and Jack Nicholson was there. And at the end of the movie, Jack said to me, you don't know if he's done with you yet, do you? And I said, yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah, but there are certain images, the elevators open, the blood coming out, the twins. Are you able to enjoy that stuff? Or is it frustrating that it doesn't line up with what you wrote?
It's a fantastic visual image. It goes back to what I said about the gorgeous Cadillac. What's it in the service of? That's the question, you know. It's not like Texas Chainsaw where you understand the girl got hung up on the meat hook. Okay, there's one girl left. Good God, what's going to happen to her? I didn't feel that way. I had other problems with it. It's a misogynistic film. I mean, Shelley Duvall is basically a dish rag that screams.
Yeah.
I mean, if you made that picture today, can you imagine the Me Too movement?
No, I mean, the bathtub with the old woman naked. It's never
Maybe it would be accepted on one level because they would say this is a perfect picture of abuse in action, so to speak. So there could be that.
One of your adaptations that I think is, I don't know if it's underrated or it's not talked about enough, but everyone who's seen it loves it, is Cujo, Louis Teague's film. I love that. That movie, I remember the first time I saw that, it was such a simple idea. The dog, and I remember the book being the biggest deal, but that movie was terrifying. I was petrified.
When people ask me, what are the ones that are your favorite movies, I always mention Cujo. It goes to sort of the prejudice that film reviewers have about horror pictures.
The acting doesn't
count. I'll tell you something, Eli.
It drives me crazy.
I got so angry at the Academy Awards the other night. There was one little flash you saw of Pennywise the Clown, and that was it. Nobody mentioned it. There was nothing about it. It didn't get nominated for any awards. But, I mean, come on. It grossed $700 million worldwide. And not only that, it was a good film. Bill Skarsgård acted his ass off as Pennywise the Clown. The kids were great. That Finn Wolfhard, that
amazing.
Played Richie.
So good.
Eddie, you know, his performance was easily the equal of Ryan O'Neal's daughter in Paper Moon.
Yeah.
She won an Academy Award. He didn't even get nominated. So none of them did.
Well, the
costume design, none of that
nothing.
Stuff.
Nothing. Cinematography, costume design, score,
that's
nothing.
That's the sort of
how about James McAvoy does not get nominated for Split?
Yeah.
And you watch that performance.
Exactly.
Playing 27 different actors flawlessly.
Exactly.
I look at Dee Wallace's performance in Cujo,
that's
and you're like, that is
to.
One of the great. Or Jason Miller in The Exorcist. Dee Wallace and Cujo. I was
Wallace
is one of the great
nominated.
Performances.
That was one of the great bravura performances of all time. And the movie is so simple because that's what, to me, horror is always situational. It's something where you say to yourself, okay, we're going to put a woman and a boy in the car, and then we're going to see what happens. I had sun on a hot summer day, and it just works like that. They had like 7 different dogs that worked on it. They built a Ford Pinto entirely out of shell aluminum so that when the dog hit
it
the door,
so
it would crumple like that. And I remember those people. It was an outfit called Sun International that actually produced the movie. And I was in New York, and they came, and we sat around, and we talked about it a little bit. And the guy said, I'm going to say something now that you'll probably get mad about. And I said, what's that? He said, we think the little boy should live at the end of the movie. Tad dies at the end of the book. And I said, look, if you make a movie, it's got a different kind of audience with different expectations. And if that little boy dies, I think they're probably going to come out of the theaters and they're going to want to lynch you. So go with God. I've always felt that way about the movies. Do what you're going to do, and then, you know, we'll see what works and what doesn't. I always feel like what I write works, and they should do that. But if they don't, go with God. Tad lives at the end of the movie, but there's a scene earlier on where after Cujo has been bitten by the bat and he has the rabies, where the dog licks the little boy's face. So I always tell people, you know, the little boy lives at the end of the movie, and then after the movie's over, he died horribly of rabies.
For rabies, yeah. No cure for rabies.
But it's a good movie, and it keeps it simple, and it really works. Fred Sears made that movie. Anyway, it was supposed to be directed by the guy who directed Woodstock,
Michael Whatley?
Michael Whatley, I think that was it.
And yeah, he was on board. Wolfen.
Yeah.
He was probably shooting, yeah.
He shot 2 days and he said, I can't do this, and he walked out.
Really? Michael Whatley, I had no idea.
Yeah,
Well, he had just done a wolf movie, so then to go from a wolf to a dog might have been pretty tricky.
Right.
Louis Teague then...
came on, yes.
Yeah, well, Louis Teague went from Cujo, from your dog movie, to Cat's Eye.
He went to Cat's Eye, yeah.
Which, I loved Cat's Eye. Cat's Eye was almost like, like after Creepshow, it was almost like a PG-13 Creepshow, but that image of the girl dancing in the box to 96 Tears was one of the most dramatic things in Quitters Incorporated. It was one of the best adaptations of your work I'd ever seen.
I talked to Lewis about Cat's Eye before they started shooting. Cat's Eye was the second PG-13 movie.
I remember it.
Ever released. And,
was the first one Dreamscape or Temple of Doom? I think Temple of Doom was creative. It was like Temple of Doom, Dreamscape, Runaway, and Cat's Eye. I remember seeing anything.
I think it was Runaway because
Tom Selleck.
I was afraid when they said that we're going to do this as a PG-13. I said, you know what? I don't think anybody will go see a PG-13 movie because the parents of young children will think it's too scary, and kids who are older will think it's too childish.
Yeah.
And for a while, PG-13 movies didn't really work that well. But I went up to Louis Teague and I said, didn't W.C. Fields say never work with children or animals?
Yeah.
I said,
and
he said,
both.
I've never had that problem.
Vampires. Salem's Lot freaked me out. First, being Jewish, the cross thing never, I was like, is that all it takes? It was like, really? Are they that afraid? What if they're Jewish vampires? That's always my first thought. Salem's Lot, I remember.
Well, you know,
Nosferatu.
The priest uses the cross on the vampire, and the vampire walks up to him and snaps it in 2 pieces and drops it on the floor. He says it only works if you believe.
Oh. Well, that Salem's Lot, I remember being so scared by that movie, not just because of the way the vampire looked, but because during the day, opening the coffin, that was the first time I had seen horror stuff that was shot during the day that petrified me, and floating around at night. I mean, there was a whole wave of vampire movies that were romantic and sexy, and you really restored it to being absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. Reggie Nalder was great as the vampire.
Tell me about, you know, writing Salem's Lot, the shooting of the movie, what you like or dislike about the romantic vampire versus the scary dead guy.
Well, vampires are supposed to be awful. I mean, I grew up reading Dracula and reading about the stink of the grave, the graveyard earth that the vampire was in with the worms crawling in it, about his fated breath. And the whole thing was like, it was supposed to be ugly and nasty, and I wanted that kind of a vampire. I'm never very interested in the romantic Interview with a Vampire movie, Tom Cruise.
I remember Interview with a Vampire, everyone coming out of that movie, and I was like, why don't they just walk into light? They're all complaining. They know how to kill themselves. Why don't they just do it?
Right.
But do you think Anne Rice, what she injected, there's a whole audience that sort of, I think, the Interview with a Vampire, because it was Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise, became a gateway drug for horror for a lot of fans.
The thing is, the vampire, the whole vampire idea, the romantic vampire has always been popular with teens and early 20s and things, particularly women, because it's seen as almost like no-fault sex. The vampire is very handsome and very hypnotic. And after all, what's he really going to do? He's going to give you a great big hickey, like on Lover's Lane. But that's not the way it's supposed to be, you know, to my mind. You know, I wanted the whole schmear where the vampires turn more vampires and they can't come out in the daylight and all that stuff. I'm a classicist, man.
There was a photo of one kid at Comic-Con when Twilight came out. There was like some angry kid with a huge placard that said Nosferatu didn't sparkle. Yeah, and I was like, exactly. That's me. I'm
that's
that kid.
Right. I can remember being at an autographing thing not too long after that book came out, and this kid walked up to me and he said, you know, you ought to do a squeal in that Jenner. And I'm like, what? And finally I figured out he was saying you ought to do a sequel in that genre.
A squeal in that Jenner.
A squeal in that Jenner. It turned out that this kid was the only one in his family who read, and he'd read Salem's Lot to death. But Toby Hooper made it. He made it on a budget.
By the way, speaking of the Academy Awards, I was really angry that Toby Hooper was not mentioned in the In Memoriam.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy did Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Poltergeist, Eaten Alive, like Salem's Lot. That guy has made so many seminal movies.
He's a seminal
But because it's horror, they think it doesn't count.
That's right. But on the other hand, I was in that montage. So, what can I say? That's great.
I know, like, you don't want to play favorites, but is there one adaptation of yours that you're like, that's the one that nailed exactly what was in my head? Or do you not judge it by that?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about one of the balls-to-the-wall horror movies. But there are a lot of things that, you know, you talk about wanting that moment. The version of Gerald's Game.
Yeah.
It was on Netflix. There's a degloving scene in that that's very hard to watch. And that's a great moment in a really good film. There are things in Christine, John Carpenter's movie, that I really like, with a car on fire, indelible images. But if I had to say, what's the one movie that's really, really scary and just is unrelenting, I would say probably Rob Reiner's Misery. You know, because it all builds up to that scene.
The penguin. It's the little things. The hobbling is as effective as him putting the penguin. When he puts the penguin the wrong way, the whole audience went, no, she's gonna know. It's the simplest, it's as effective as the image of that foot and the hobbling.
One of the things that made that film work and made Rob Reiner the perfect person to do it is because humor and horror are really two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always say, it stops being funny when it starts being you. A lot of times in a horror movie, something really terrible will happen and the audience will go, ah! And then they'll laugh, you know, because they're trying to play it off a little bit, so.
Awesome.
And Misery has a lot of funny things in it. That whole Liberace thing wasn't in the book.
Really?
How crazy she is about Liberace.
She was amazing. And that was, by the way, that and Silence of the Lambs are the first time I remember what we would call horror movies, but they had to call them thrillers, so they were classy.
Yeah.
Winning awards, that was the first time. And then this year you see Get Out winning for screenplay, which is pretty cool.
But it's,
and Guillermo winning for Shape of Water.
I know, that was an excellent thing.
That's cool. I mean, that's like the Oscar version of Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Eli, come on now. How much respect do you really want to have? Because the more respect that we get in this field, the less I feel like we're doing our job, you know?
I mean, my latest film is at the critic rating 15% on Rotten Tomatoes, and the audience is at 85%, so it's like, my work is done
here. This is why I love February and March, because you see that. If I see a movie like that, and it's got that little Rotten Tomatoes booger splat, I say to myself, I want to go see that one, man.
Awesome.
I want to go see that.
Well, thank you so much.
Hey, can't get enough of the conversation? Eli Roth's History of Horror is now streaming on Shudder, full and commercial-free. At Shudder, we're the best selection in streaming genre. It's handpicked and curated by experts, including me. We cover the amazing spectrum of horror, thrillers, and suspense, including breakout revenge essentials like Mandy and Revenge, all-time classic The Changeling, horror fantasy hit series A Discovery of Witches, and our new Shudder original documentary, Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. Start your free 2-week trial with promo code SHUDDERPOD. That's promo code SHUDDERPOD. History of Horror Uncut is a Shudder original podcast. Hosted by Sam Zimmerman, produced by Liam Finn, sound designed by Jeremy Lee, music composed by Michael Tioli. Special thanks to executive producers Eli Roth, Kurt Sayenga, Jonathan Koch, Stephen Michaels, James McNabb, Allison Berkeley, and Joseph Fried, as well as the AMC Networks and AMC Studio Development and Production teams who allowed us at Shudder to make this. For Shudder, Owen Shiflett, Nicholas Lazo, and Robin Jones. This podcast is protected under the laws of the United States and other countries, and its unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition may result in civil liability and criminal prosecution. Country of first publication, United States of America. History of Horror, Uncut.